and risk on an everyday scale, the scale on which grant-giving bodies assess research proposals submitted by chemists. Yet even so big a gap as this is easily filled by statistically informed science, while the very same statistical science rules out a divine creator on the ultimate 747 grounds we met earlier.
But now, to return to the interesting point that launched this section. Suppose somebody tried to explain the general phenomenon of biological adaptation along the same lines as we have just applied to the origin of life, appealing to an immense number of available planets. The observed fact is that every species and every organ that has ever been looked at within every species is good at what it does. The wings of birds, bees, and bats are good at flying, eyes are good at seeing, leaves are good at photosynthesizing. We live on a planet where we are surrounded by perhaps 10 million species, each one of which independently displays a powerful illusion of apparent design. Each species is well fitted to its particular way of life. Could we get away with the huge numbers of planets argument to explain all these separate illusions of design? No, we could not. Repeat not. Don't even think about it. This is important, for it goes to the heart of the most serious misunderstanding of Darwinism. It doesn't matter how many planets we have to play with. Lucky chance could never be enough to explain the lush diversity of living complexity on Earth in the same way as we used it to explain the existence of life here in the first place. The evolution of life is a completely different case from the origin of life, because, to repeat, the origin of life was, or could have been, a unique event, which had to happen only once. The adaptive fit of species to their separate environments, on the other hand, is millionfold and ongoing.
It is clear that here on Earth we are dealing with a generalized process for optimizing biological species, a process that works all over the planet, on all continents and islands, and at all times. We can safely predict that if we wait another 10 million years, a whole new set of species will be as well adapted to their ways of life as today's species are to theirs. This is a recurrent, predictable, multiple phenomenon, not a piece of statistical luck recognized with hindsight. And thanks to Darwin, we know how it is brought about. By natural selection. The anthropic principle is impotent to explain the multifarious details of living creatures. We really need Darwin's powerful crane to account for the diversity of life on Earth, and especially the persuasive illusion of design. The origin of life, by contrast, lies outside the reach of that crane, because natural selection cannot proceed without it. Here, the anthropic principle comes into its own. We can deal with the unique origin of life by postulating a very large number of planetary opportunities. Once that initial stroke of luck has been granted, and the anthropic principle most decisively grants it to us, natural selection takes over. And natural selection is emphatically not a matter of luck.
Nevertheless, it may be that the origin of life is not the only major gap in the evolutionary story that is bridged by sheer luck, anthropically justified. For example, my colleague Mark Ridley, in Mendel's Demon, gratuitously and confusingly retitled The Cooperative Gene by his American publishers, has suggested that the origin of the eukaryotic cell, our kind of cell, with a nucleus and various other complicated features, such as mitochondria, which are not present in bacteria, was an even more momentous, difficult, and statistically improbable step than the origin of life. The origin of consciousness might be another major gap whose bridging was of the same order of improbability. One-off events like this might be explained by the anthropic principle along the following lines. There are billions of planets that have developed life at the level of bacteria, but only a fraction of these life forms ever made it across the gap to something like the eukaryotic cell. And of these, a yet smaller fraction managed to cross the later Rubicon to consciousness. If both of these are one-off events, we are not dealing with a ubiquitous and all-pervading process, as we are with ordinary, run-of-the-mill biological adaptation. The anthropic principle states that, since we are alive, eukaryotic, and conscious, our planet has to be one of the intensely rare planets that has bridged all three gaps.
Natural selection works because it is a cumulative one-way street to improvement. It needs some luck to get started, and the billions of planets' anthropic principle grants it that luck. Maybe a few later gaps in the evolutionary story also need major infusions of luck, with anthropic justification. But whatever else we may say, design certainly does not work as an explanation for life, because design is ultimately not cumulative, and it therefore raises bigger questions than it answers. It takes us straight back along the ultimate 747 infinite regress. We live on a planet that is friendly to our kind of life, and we have seen two reasons why this is so. One is that life has evolved to flourish in the conditions provided by the planet. This is because of natural selection. The other reason is the anthropic one. There are billions of planets in the universe, and however small the minority of evolution-friendly planets may be, our planet necessarily has to be one of them. Now it is time to take the anthropic principle back to an earlier stage, from biology back to cosmology. The anthropic principle, cosmological version. We live not only on a friendly planet, but also in a friendly universe. It follows from the fact of our existence that the laws of physics must be friendly enough to allow life to arise. It is no accident that when we look at the night sky, we see stars, for stars are a necessary prerequisite for the existence of most of the chemical elements, and without chemistry, there could be no life. Physicists have calculated that if the laws and constants of physics had been even slightly different, the universe would have developed in such a way that life would have been impossible. Different physicists put it in different ways, but the conclusion is always much the same. Martin Rees, in Just Six Numbers, lists six fundamental constants which are believed to hold all around the universe. Each of these six numbers is finely tuned, in the sense that if it were slightly different, the universe would be comprehensively different and presumably unfriendly to life.
We must say presumably, partly because we don't know how different alien forms of life might be, and partly because it is possible that we make a mistake if we consider only the consequences of changing one constant at a time. Could there be other combinations of values of the six numbers which would turn out to be friendly to life in ways that we do not discover if we consider them only one at a time? Nevertheless, we shall proceed for simplicity as though we really do have a big problem to explain in the apparent fine-tuning of the fundamental constants.
An example of Rees's six numbers is the magnitude of the so-called strong force, the force that binds the components of an atomic nucleus, the nuclear force that has to be overcome when one splits the atom. It is measured as E, the proportion of the mass of a hydrogen nucleus that is converted to energy when hydrogen fuses to form helium. The value of this number in our universe is 0.007, and it looks as though it had to be very close to this value in order for any chemistry, which is a prerequisite for life, to exist. Chemistry as we know it consists of the combination and recombination of the 90 or so naturally occurring elements of the periodic table. Hydrogen is the simplest and commonest of the elements. All the other elements in the universe are made ultimately from hydrogen by nuclear fusion. Nuclear fusion is a difficult process which occurs in the intensely hot conditions of the interiors of stars and in hydrogen bombs. Relatively small stars, such as our Sun, can make only light elements such as helium, the second lightest in the periodic table after hydrogen. It takes larger and hotter stars to develop the high temperatures needed to forge most of the heavier elements in a cascade of nuclear fusion processes whose details were worked out by Fred Hoyle and two colleagues, an achievement for which, mysteriously, Hoyle was not given a share of the Nobel Prize received by the others. These big stars may explode as supernovas, scattering their materials, including the elements of the periodic table, in dust clouds. These dust clouds eventually condense to form new stars and planets, including our own. This is why Earth is rich in elements over and above the ubiquitous hydrogen, elements without which chemistry and life would be impossible. The relevant point here is that the value of the strong force crucially determines how far up the periodic table the nuclear fusion cascade goes. If the strong force were too small, say 0.006 instead of 0.007, the universe would contain nothing but hydrogen and no interesting chemistry could result. If it were too large, say 0.008, all the hydrogen would have fused to make heavier elements. A chemistry without hydrogen could not generate life as we know it. For one thing, there would be no water. The Goldilocks value, 0.007, is just right for yielding the richness of elements that we need for an interesting and life-supporting chemistry.
I won't go through the rest of Reese's six numbers. The bottom line for each of them is the same. The actual number sits in a Goldilocks band of values outside which life would not have been possible. How should we respond to this? Yet again, we have the theist answer on the one hand and the anthropic answer on the other. The theist says that God, when setting up the universe, tuned the fundamental constants of the universe so that each one lay in its Goldilocks zone for the production of life. It is as though God had six knobs that he could twiddle, and he carefully tuned each knob to its Goldilocks value. As ever, the theist answer is deeply unsatisfying, because it leaves the existence of God unexplained. A God capable of calculating the Goldilocks values for the six numbers would have to be at least as improbable as the finely tuned combination of numbers itself, and that's very improbable indeed, which is indeed the premise of the whole discussion we are having. It follows that the theist's answer has utterly failed to make any headway towards solving the problem at hand. I see no alternative but to dismiss it, while at the same time marvelling at the number of people who can't see the problem and seem genuinely satisfied by the divine knob-twiddler argument. Maybe the psychological reason for this amazing blindness has something to do with the fact that many people have not had their consciousness raised, as biologists have, by natural selection and its power to tame improbability. J. Anderson Thompson, from his perspective as an evolutionary psychiatrist, points me to an additional reason, the psychological bias that we all have towards personifying inanimate objects as agents. As Thompson says, we are more inclined to mistake a shadow for a burglar than a burglar for a shadow. A false positive might be a waste of time. A false negative could be fatal. In a letter to me, he suggested that, in our ancestral past, our greatest challenge in our environment came from each other.
The legacy of that is the default assumption, often fear, of human intention. We have a great deal of difficulty seeing anything other than human causation.
We naturally generalize that to divine intention. I shall return to the seductiveness of agents in Chapter 5.
Biologists, with their raised consciousness of the power of natural selection to explain the rise of improbable things, are unlikely to be satisfied with any theory that evades the problem of improbability altogether. And the theistic response to the riddle of improbability is an evasion of stupendous proportions. It is more than a restatement of the problem, it is a grotesque amplification of it. Let's turn, then, to the anthropic alternative. The anthropic answer, in its most general form, is that we could only be discussing the question in the kind of universe that was capable of producing us. Our existence, therefore, determines that the fundamental constants of physics had to be in their respective Goldilocks zones. Different physicists espouse different kinds of anthropic solutions to the riddle of our existence. Hard-nosed physicists say that the six knobs were never free to vary in the first place. When we finally reach the long-hoped-for theory of everything, we shall see that the six key numbers depend upon each other or on something else as yet unknown in ways that we today cannot imagine. The six numbers may turn out to be no freer to vary than is the ratio of a circle's circumference to its diameter. It will turn out that there is only one way for a universe to be. Far from God being needed to twiddle six knobs, there are no knobs to twiddle.
Other physicists, Martin Rees himself would be an example, find this unsatisfying, and I think I agree with them. It is indeed perfectly plausible that there is only one way for a universe to be. But why did that one way have to be such a setup for our eventual evolution? Why did it have to be the kind of universe which seems almost as if, in the words of the theoretical physicist Freeman Dyson, it must have known we were coming? The philosopher John Leslie uses the analogy of a man sentenced to death by firing squad. It is just possible that all 10 men of the firing squad will miss their victim. With hindsight, the survivor, who finds himself in a position to reflect upon his luck, can cheerfully say, "Well, obviously they all missed, or I wouldn't be here thinking about it." But he could still, forgivably, wonder why they all missed, and toy with the hypothesis that they were bribed or drunk. This objection can be answered by the suggestion which Martin Rees himself supports, that there are many universes, coexisting like bubbles of foam in a multiverse, or megaverse as Leonard Susskind prefers to call it. The laws and constants of any one universe, such as our observable universe, are bylaws. The multiverse as a whole has a plethora of alternative sets of bylaws. The anthropic principle kicks in to explain that we have to be in one of those universes, presumably a minority, whose bylaws happen to be propitious to our eventual evolution and hence contemplation of the problem. An intriguing version of the multiverse theory arises out of considerations of the ultimate fate of our universe. Depending upon the values of numbers such as Martin Rees's 6 constants, our universe may be destined to expand indefinitely, or it may stabilize at an equilibrium, or the expansion may reverse itself and go into contraction, culminating in the so-called Big Crunch. Some Big Crunch models have the universe then bouncing back into expansion, and so on indefinitely with, say, a 20-billion-year cycle time. The standard model of our universe says that time itself began in the Big Bang, along with space, some 13 billion years ago. The serial Big Crunch model would amend that statement. Our time and space did indeed begin in our Big Bang, but this was just the latest in a long series of Big Bangs, each one initiated by the Big Crunch that terminated the previous universe in the series. Nobody understands what goes on in singularities such as the Big Bang, so it is conceivable that the laws and constants are reset to new values each time. If bang expansion contraction crunch cycles have been going on forever, like a cosmic accordion, we have a serial rather than a parallel version of the multiverse. Once again, the anthropic principle does its explanatory duty. Of all the universes in the series, only a minority have their dials tuned to biogenic conditions. And of course the present universe has to be one of that minority because we are in it. As it turns out, this serial version of the multiverse must now be judged less likely than it once was, because recent evidence is starting to steer us away from the Big Crunch model. It now looks as though our own universe is destined to expand forever.
Another theoretical physicist, Lee Smolin, has developed a tantalizingly Darwinian variant on the multiverse theory, including both serial and parallel elements. Smolin's idea, expounded in The Life of the Cosmos, hinges on the theory that daughter universes are born of parent universes, not in a fully fledged Big Crunch, but more locally in black holes. Smolin adds a form of heredity. The fundamental constants of a daughter universe are slightly mutated versions of the constants of its parent. Heredity is the essential ingredient of Darwinian natural selection, and the rest of Smolin's theory follows naturally. Those universes that have what it takes to survive and reproduce come to predominate in the multiverse. What it takes includes lasting long enough to reproduce. Because the act of reproduction takes place in black holes, successful universes must have what it takes to make black holes. This ability entails various other properties. For example, the tendency for matter to condense into clouds and then stars is a prerequisite to making black holes. Stars also, as we have seen, are the precursors to the development of interesting chemistry and hence life. So, Smolin suggests that there has been a Darwinian natural selection of universes in the multiverse, directly favouring the evolution of black hole fecundity and indirectly favouring the production of life. Not all physicists are enthusiastic about Smolin's idea, although the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Murray Gell-Mann is quoted as saying,
"Smolin? Is he that young guy with those crazy ideas? he may not be wrong.
A mischievous biologist might wonder whether some other physicists are in need of Darwinian consciousness raising. It is tempting to think, and many have succumbed, that to postulate a plethora of universes is a profligate luxury which should not be allowed. If we are going to permit the extravagance of a multiverse, so the argument runs, we might as well be hung for a sheep as a lamb and allow a god. Aren't they both equally unparsimonious ad hoc hypotheses and equally unsatisfactory? People who think that have not had their consciousness raised by natural selection. The key difference between the genuinely extravagant god hypothesis and the apparently extravagant multiverse hypothesis is one of statistical improbability. The multiverse, for all that it is extravagant, is simple. God, or any intelligent, decision-taking, calculating agent, would have to be highly improbable in the very same statistical sense as the entities he is supposed to explain. The multiverse may seem extravagant in sheer number of universes, but if each one of those universes is simple in its fundamental laws, we are still not postulating anything highly improbable. The very opposite has to be said of any kind of intelligence.
Some physicists are known to be religious. Russell Stannard and the Reverend John Polkinghorne are the two British examples I mentioned. Predictably, they seize upon the improbability of the physical constants all being tuned in their more or less narrow Goldilocks zones and suggest that there must be a cosmic intelligence who deliberately did the tuning. I have already dismissed all such suggestions as raising bigger problems than they solve. But what attempts have theists made to reply? How do they cope with the argument that any god capable of designing a universe, carefully and foresightfully tuned to lead to our evolution, must be a supremely complex and improbable entity who needs an even bigger explanation than the one he's supposed to provide? The theologian Richard Swinburne, as we have learned to expect, thinks he has an answer to this problem, and he expounds it in his book, Is There a God? He begins by showing that his heart is in the right place by convincingly demonstrating why we should always prefer the simplest hypothesis that fits the facts. Science explains complex things in terms of the interactions of simpler things, ultimately the interactions of fundamental particles. I, and I dare say you, think it a beautifully simple idea that all things are made of fundamental particles which, although exceedingly numerous, are drawn from a small, finite set of types of particle. If we are sceptical, it is likely to be because we think the idea too simple. But for Swinburne, it is not simple at all, quite the reverse. Given that the number of particles of any one type, say electrons, is large, Swinburne thinks it too much of a coincidence that so many should have the same properties. One electron he could stomach, but billions and billions of electrons, all with the same properties, that is what really excites his incredulity. For him it would be simpler, more natural, less demanding of explanation, if all electrons were different from each other. Worse, no one electron should naturally retain its properties for more than an instant at a time. Each should change capriciously, haphazardly, and fleetingly from moment to moment. That is Swinburne's view of the simple native state of affairs. Anything more uniform, what you or I would call more simple, requires a special explanation.
It is only because electrons and bits of copper and all other material objects have the same powers in the 20th century as they did in the 19th century that things are as they are now.
Enter God. God comes to the rescue by deliberately and continuously sustaining the properties of all those billions of electrons and bits of copper and neutralizing their otherwise ingrained inclination to wild and erratic fluctuation.
That is why, when you've seen one electron, you've seen them all. That is why bits of copper all behave like bits of copper. And that is why each electron and each bit of copper stays the same as itself from microsecond to microsecond and from century to century. It is because God constantly keeps a finger on each and every particle, curbing its reckless excesses and whipping it into line with its colleagues to keep them all the same.
But how can Swinburne possibly maintain that this hypothesis of God simultaneously keeping a gazillion fingers on wayward electrons is a simple hypothesis? It is, of course, precisely the opposite of simple. Swinburne pulls off the trick to his own satisfaction by a breathtaking piece of intellectual chutzpah. He asserts, without justification, that God is only a single substance. What brilliant economy of explanatory causes, compared with all those gigazillions of independent electrons, all just happening to be the same.
Theism claims that every other object which exists is caused to exist and kept in existence by just one substance, God. And it claims that every property which every substance has is due to God causing or permitting it to exist. It is a hallmark of a simple explanation to postulate few causes. There could in this respect be no simpler explanation than one which postulated only one cause. Theism is simpler than polytheism. And theism postulates for its one cause a person with infinite power, God can do anything logically possible, infinite knowledge, God knows everything logically possible to know, and infinite freedom.
Swinburne generously concedes that God cannot accomplish feats that are logically impossible, and one feels grateful for this forbearance. Having said that, there is no limit to the explanatory purposes to which God's infinite power is put.
Is science having a little difficulty explaining X? No problem. Don't give X another glance. God's infinite power is effortlessly wheeled in to explain X, along with everything else. And it is always a supremely simple explanation because, after all, there is only one God. What could be simpler than that?
Well, actually, almost everything. A God capable of continuously monitoring and controlling the individual status of every particle in the universe cannot be simple. His existence is going to need a mammoth explanation in its own right. Worse, from the point of view of simplicity, other corners of God's giant consciousness are simultaneously preoccupied with the doings and emotions and prayers of every single human being, and whatever intelligent aliens there might be on other planets in this and 100 billion other galaxies. He even, according to Swinburne, has to decide continuously not to intervene miraculously to save us when we get cancer. That would never do for...
If God answered most prayers for a relative to recover from cancer, then cancer would no longer be a problem for humans to solve.
And then what would be fine to do with our time? Not all theologians go as far as Swinburne. Nevertheless, the remarkable suggestion that the God hypothesis is simple can be found in other modern theological writings. Keith Ward, then Regius Professor of Divinity at Oxford, was very clear on the matter in his 1996 book, God, Chance, and Necessity.
As a matter of fact, the theist would claim that God is a very elegant, economical, and fruitful explanation for the existence of the universe. It is economical because it attributes the existence and nature of absolutely everything in the universe to just one being, an ultimate cause which assigns a reason for the existence of everything, including itself. It is elegant because from one key idea, the idea of the most perfect possible being, the whole nature of God and the existence of the universe can be intelligibly explicated.
Like Swinburne, Ward mistakes what it means to explain something, and he also seems not to understand what it means to say of something that it is simple. I'm not clear whether Ward really thinks God is simple, or whether the above passage represented a temporary, for the sake of argument, exercise. Ward earlier criticized the thought of Thomas Aquinas.
Its basic error is in supposing that God is logically simple. Simple not just in the sense that his being is indivisible, but in the much stronger sense that what is true of any part of God is true of the whole. It is quite coherent, however, to suppose that God, while indivisible, is internally complex.
Ward gets it right here. Indeed, the biologist Julian Huxley in 1912 defined complexity in terms of heterogeneity of parts, by which he meant a particular kind of functional indivisibility. Elsewhere, Ward gives evidence of the difficulty the theological mind has in grasping where the complexity of life comes from. He quotes another theologian scientist, the biochemist Arthur Peacock, the third member of my trio of British religious scientists, as postulating the existence in living matter of a propensity for increased complexity. Ward characterizes this as some inherent weighting of evolutionary change which favours complexity. He goes on to suggest that such a bias might be some weighting of the mutational process to ensure that more complex mutations occurred. Ward is sceptical of this, as well he should be. The evolutionary drive towards complexity comes, in those lineages where it comes at all, not from any inherent propensity for increased complexity, and not from biased mutation. It comes from natural selection, the process which, as far as we know, is the only process ultimately capable of generating complexity out of simplicity. The theory of natural selection is genuinely simple. So is the origin from which it starts. That which it explains, on the other hand, is complex almost beyond telling, more complex than anything we can imagine, save a God capable of designing it. An interlude at Cambridge. At a recent Cambridge conference on science and religion, where I put forward the argument I'm here calling the ultimate 747 argument, I encountered what, to say the least, was a cordial failure to achieve a meeting of minds on the question of God's simplicity. The experience was a revealing one, and I'd like to share it. First, I should confess, that is probably the right word, that the conference was sponsored by the Templeton Foundation. The audience was a small number of hand-picked science journalists from Britain and America. I was the token atheist among the 18 invited speakers. One of the journalists, John Horgan, reported that they had each been paid the handsome sum of $15,000 to attend the conference, on top of all expenses. This surprised me. My long experience of academic conferences included no instances where the audience, as opposed to the speakers, was paid to attend. If I had known, my suspicions would immediately have been aroused. Was Templeton using his money to suborn science journalists and subvert their scientific integrity? John Horgan later wondered the same thing and wrote an article about his whole experience. In it, he revealed, to my chagrin, that my advertised involvement as a speaker had helped him and others to overcome their doubts.
The British biologist Richard Dawkins, whose participation in the meeting helped convince me and other fellows of its legitimacy, was the only speaker who denounced religious beliefs as incompatible with science, irrational, and harmful. The other speakers, three agnostics, one Jew, a deist, and 12 Christians, a Muslim philosopher cancelled at the last minute, offered a perspective clearly skewed in favour of religion and Christianity.
Horgan's article is itself endearingly ambivalent. Despite his misgivings, there were aspects of the experience that he clearly valued, and so did I, as will become apparent below. Horgan wrote,
"My conversations with the faithful deepened my appreciation of why some intelligent, well-educated people embrace religion. One reporter discussed the experience of speaking in tongues, and another described having an intimate relationship with Jesus. My convictions did not change, but others did. At least one fellow said that his faith was wavering as a result of Dawkins's dissection of religion. And if the Templeton Foundation can help bring about even such a tiny step toward my vision of a world without religion, how bad can it be?"
Horgan's article was given a second airing by the literary agent John Brockman on his Edge website, often described as an online scientific salon, where it elicited varying responses, including one from the theoretical physicist Freeman Dyson. I responded to Dyson, quoting from his acceptance speech when he won the Templeton Prize. Whether he liked it or not, by accepting the Templeton Prize, Dyson had sent a powerful signal to the world. It would be taken as an endorsement of religion by one of the world's most distinguished physicists.
"I am content to be one of the multitude of Christians who do not care much about the doctrine of the Trinity or the historical truth of the Gospels."
But isn't that exactly what any atheistic scientist would say if he wanted to sound Christian? I gave further quotations from Dyson's acceptance speech, satirically interspersing them with imagined questions to a Templeton official.
"Oh, you want something a bit more profound as well. How about, I do not make any clear distinction between mind and God. God is what mind becomes when it has passed beyond the scale of our comprehension." Have I said enough yet, and can I get back to doing physics now? Not enough yet. Okay, then. How about this? Even in the gruesome history of the 20th century, I see some evidence of progress in religion. The two individuals who epitomized the evils of our century, Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin, were both avowed atheists. Can I go now?
Dyson could easily refute the implication of these quotations from his Templeton acceptance speech, if only he would explain clearly what evidence he finds to believe in God, in something more than just the Einsteinian sense which, as I explained in Chapter 1, we can all trivially subscribe to. If I understand Horgan's point, it is that Templeton's money corrupts science. I'm sure Freeman Dyson is way above being corrupted, but his acceptance speech is still unfortunate if it seems to set an example to others. The Templeton Prize is two orders of magnitude larger than the inducements offered to the journalists at Cambridge, having been explicitly set up to be larger than the Nobel Prize. In Faustian vein, my friend the philosopher Daniel Dennett once joked to me, "Richard, if ever you fall on hard times..." For better or worse, I attended 2 days at the Cambridge conference, giving a talk of my own and taking part in the discussion of several other talks. I challenged the theologians to answer the point that a God capable of designing a universe, or anything else, would have to be complex and statistically improbable. The strongest response I heard was that I was brutally foisting a scientific epistemology upon an unwilling theology. Theologians had always defined God as simple. Who was I, a scientist, to dictate to theologians that their God had to be complex? Scientific arguments, such as those I was accustomed to deploying in my own field, were inappropriate, since theologians had always maintained that God lay outside science. I did not gain the impression that the theologians who mounted this evasive defence were being willfully dishonest. I think they were sincere. Nevertheless, I was irresistibly reminded of Peter Medawar's comment on Father Teilhard de Chardin's The Phenomenon of Man, in the course of what is possibly the greatest negative book review of all time.
Its author can be excused of dishonesty only on the grounds that before deceiving others, he has taken great pains to deceive himself.
The theologians of my Cambridge encounter were defining themselves into an epistemological safe zone, where rational argument could not reach them because they had declared by fiat that it could not. Who was I to say that rational argument was the only admissible kind of argument? There are other ways of knowing besides the scientific, and it is one of these other ways of knowing that must be deployed to know God. The most important of these other ways of knowing turned out to be personal, subjective experience of God. Several discussants at Cambridge claimed that God spoke to them inside their heads, just as vividly and as personally as another human might. I have dealt with illusion and hallucination in Chapter 3, the argument from personal experience, but at the Cambridge conference I added 2 points. First, that if God really did communicate with humans, that fact would emphatically not lie outside science. God comes bursting through from whatever otherworldly domain is his natural abode, crashing through into our world where his messages can be intercepted by human brains. Has that phenomenon really nothing to do with science? Second, a God who is capable of sending intelligible signals to millions of people simultaneously and of receiving messages from all of them simultaneously cannot be, whatever else he might be, simple. Such bandwidth! God may not have a brain made of neurons or a CPU made of silicon, but if he has the powers attributed to him, he must have something far more elaborately and non-randomly constructed than the largest brain or the largest computer we know. Time and again my theologian friends returned to the point that there had to be a reason why there is something rather than nothing. There must have been a first cause of everything, and we might as well give it the name God. Yes, I said, but it must have been simple, and therefore whatever else we call it, God is not an appropriate name, unless we very explicitly divest it of all the baggage that the word God carries in the minds of most religious believers. The first cause that we seek must have been the simple basis for a self-bootstrapping crane, which eventually raised the world as we know it into its present complex existence. To suggest that the original prime mover was complicated enough to indulge in intelligent design, to say nothing of mind-reading millions of humans simultaneously, is tantamount to dealing yourself a perfect hand at bridge. Look around at the world of life, at the Amazon rainforest, with its rich interlacement of lianas, bromeliads, roots and flying buttresses, its army ants and its jaguars, its tapirs and peccaries, tree frogs and parrots. What you are looking at is the statistical equivalent of a perfect hand of cards. Think of all the other ways you could permute the parts, none of which would work. Except that we know how it came about, by the gradualistic crane of natural selection. It is not just scientists who revolt at mute acceptance of such improbability arising spontaneously. Common sense balks too. To suggest that the first cause, the great unknown which is responsible for something existing rather than nothing, is a being capable of designing the universe and of talking to a million people simultaneously, is a total abdication of the responsibility to find an explanation. It is a dreadful exhibition of self-indulgent, thought-denying skyhookery. I am not advocating some sort of narrowly scientistic way of thinking, but the very least that any honest quest for truth must have in setting out to explain such monstrosities of improbability as a rainforest, a coral reef, or a universe is a crane and not a skyhook. The crane doesn't have to be natural selection. Admittedly, nobody has ever thought of a better one, but there could be others yet to be discovered. Maybe the inflation that physicists postulate as occupying some fraction of the first yoctosecond of the universe's existence will turn out, when it is better understood, to be a cosmological crane to stand alongside Darwin's biological one. Or maybe the elusive crane that cosmologists seek will be a version of Darwin's idea itself, either Smolin's model or something similar. Or maybe it will be the multiverse plus anthropic principle espoused by Martin Rees and others. It may even be a superhuman designer. But if so, it will most certainly not be a designer who just popped into existence, or who always existed. If, which I don't believe for a moment, our universe was designed, and a fortiori, if the designer reads our thoughts and hands out omniscient advice, forgiveness and redemption, the designer himself must be the end product of some kind of cumulative escalator or crane, perhaps a version of Darwinism in another universe. The last-ditch defence by my critics at Cambridge was attack. My whole worldview was condemned as 19th century. This is such a bad argument that I almost omitted to mention it, but regrettably I encounter it rather frequently. Needless to say, to call an argument 19th century is not the same as explaining what is wrong with it. Some 19th century ideas were very good ideas, not least Darwin's own dangerous idea. In any case, this particular piece of name-calling seemed a bit rich, coming as it did from an individual, a distinguished Cambridge geologist, surely well advanced along the Faustian road to a future Templeton Prize, who justified his own Christian belief by invoking what he called the historicity of the New Testament. It was precisely in the 19th century that theologians, especially in Germany, called into grave doubt that alleged historicity, using the evidence-based methods of history to do so. This was, indeed, swiftly pointed out by the theologians at the Cambridge Conference. In any case, I know the 19th century taunt of old. It goes with the village atheist jibe. It goes with...
Contrary to what you seem to think, ha, 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 we don't believe in an old man with a long white beard anymore. Ha, ha, ha.
All three jibes are code for something else. Just as when I lived in America in the late 1960s, law and order was politicians' code for anti-black prejudice. What, then, is the coded meaning of
"you are so 19th century"
in the context of an argument about religion? It is code for
"you are so crude and unsubtle. How could you be so insensitive and ill-mannered as to ask me a direct, point-blank question like, do you believe in miracles, or do you believe Jesus was born of a virgin? Don't you know that in polite society we don't ask such questions? That sort of question went out in the 19th century."
But think about why it is impolite to ask such direct, factual questions of religious people today. It is because it is embarrassing. But it is the answer that is embarrassing, if it is yes. The 19th century connection is now clear. The 19th century is the last time when it was possible for an educated person to admit to believing in miracles like the virgin birth without embarrassment. When pressed, many educated Christians today are too loyal to deny the virgin birth and the resurrection. but it embarrasses them because their rational minds know it is absurd, so they would much rather not be asked. Hence, if somebody like me insists on asking the question, it is I who am accused of being 19th century. It's really quite funny when you think about it. I left the conference stimulated and invigorated, and reinforced in my conviction that the argument from improbability, the ultimate 747 gambit, is a very serious argument against the existence of God, and one to which I have yet to hear a theologian give a convincing answer, despite numerous opportunities and invitations to do so. Dan Dennett rightly describes it as an unrebuttable refutation, as devastating today as when Philo used it to trounce Cleanthes in Hume's dialogues 2 centuries earlier. A skyhook would at best simply postpone the solution to the problem, but Hume couldn't think of any cranes, so he caved in. Darwin, of course, supplied the vital crane. How Hume would have loved it. This chapter has contained the central argument of the book, and so, at the risk of sounding repetitive, let's summarize it as a series of 6 numbered points.
1. One of the greatest challenges to the human intellect over the centuries has been to explain how the complex, improbable appearance of design in the universe arises. 2. The natural temptation is to attribute the appearance of design to actual design itself. In the case of a man-made artifact such as a watch, the designer really was an intelligent engineer. It is tempting to apply the same logic to an eye or a wing, a spider or a person. 3. The temptation is a false one because the designer hypothesis immediately raises the larger problem of who designed the designer. The whole problem we started out with was the problem of explaining statistical improbability. It is obviously no solution to postulate something even more improbable. We need a crane, not a skyhook, for only a crane can do the business of working up gradually and plausibly from simplicity to otherwise improbable complexity. 4. The most ingenious and powerful crane so far discovered is Darwinian evolution by natural selection. Darwin and his successors have shown how living creatures, with their spectacular statistical improbability and appearance of design, have evolved by slow, gradual degrees from simple beginnings. We can now safely say that the illusion of design in living creatures is just that, an illusion. 5. We don't yet have an equivalent crane for physics. Some kind of multiverse theory could in principle do for physics the same explanatory work as Darwinism does for biology. This kind of explanation is superficially less satisfying than the biological version of Darwinism because it makes heavier demands on luck. But the anthropic principle entitles us to postulate far more luck than our limited human intuition is comfortable with. 6. We should not give up hope of a better crane arising in physics, something as powerful as Darwinism is for biology. But even in the absence of a strongly satisfying crane to match the biological one, the relatively weak cranes we have at present are, when abetted by the anthropic principle, self-evidently better than the self-defeating skyhook hypothesis of an intelligent designer.
If the argument of this chapter is accepted, the factual premise of religion, the God hypothesis, is untenable. God almost certainly does not exist. This is the main conclusion of the book so far. Various questions now follow. Even if we accept that God doesn't exist, doesn't religion still have a lot going for it? Isn't it consoling? Doesn't it motivate people to do good? If it weren't for religion, how would we know what is good? Why in any case be so hostile? Why, if it is false, does every culture in the world have religion? True or false, religion is ubiquitous, so where does it come from? It is to this last question that we turn next. Chapter 5. The Roots of Religion.
To an evolutionary psychologist, the universal extravagance of religious rituals with their costs in time, resources, pain and privation should suggest as vividly as a mandrill's bottom that religion may be adaptive. Marek Cohn.
The Darwinian Imperative. Everybody has their own pet theory of where religion comes from and why all human cultures have it. It gives consolation and comfort. It fosters togetherness in groups. It satisfies our yearning to understand why we exist. I shall come to explanations of this kind in a moment, but I want to begin with a prior question, one that takes precedence for reasons we shall see, a Darwinian question about natural selection.
Knowing that we are products of Darwinian evolution, we should ask what pressure or pressures exerted by natural selection originally favoured the impulse to religion. The question gains urgency from standard Darwinian considerations of economy. Religion is so wasteful, so extravagant, and Darwinian selection habitually targets and eliminates waste. Nature is a miserly accountant, grudging the pennies, watching the clock, punishing the smallest extravagance. Unrelentingly and unceasingly, as Darwin explained.
Natural selection is daily and hourly scrutinizing throughout the world every variation, even the slightest, rejecting that which is bad, preserving and adding up all that is good, silently and insensibly working, whenever and wherever opportunity offers, at the improvement of each organic being.
If a wild animal habitually performs some useless activity, natural selection will favour rival individuals who devote the time and energy instead to surviving and reproducing. Nature cannot afford frivolous jeux d'esprit. Ruthless utilitarianism trumps, even if it doesn't always seem that way. On the face of it, the tail of a peacock is a jeu d'esprit par excellence. It surely does no favours to the survival of its possessor. But it does benefit the genes that distinguish him from his less spectacular rivals. The tail is an advertisement, which buys its place in the economy of nature by attracting females. The same is true of the labour and time that a male bowerbird devotes to his bower, a sort of external tail built of grass, twigs, colourful berries, flowers, and when available, beads, baubles and bottle caps. Or to choose an example that doesn't involve advertising, there is anting, the odd habit of birds such as jays, of bathing in an ant's nest or otherwise applying ants to the feathers. Nobody's sure what the benefit of anting is. Perhaps some kind of hygiene, cleaning out parasites from the feathers. There are various other hypotheses, none of them strongly supported by evidence. But uncertainty as to details doesn't, nor should it, stop Darwinians from presuming with great confidence that anting must be for something. In this case, common sense might agree, but Darwinian logic has a particular reason for thinking that if the birds didn't do it, their statistical prospects of genetic success would be damaged, even if we don't yet know the precise root of the damage. The conclusion follows from the twin premises that natural selection punishes wastage of time and energy, and that birds are consistently observed to devote time and energy to anting. If there is a one-sentence manifesto of this adaptationist principle, it was expressed, admittedly in somewhat extreme and exaggerated terms, by the distinguished Harvard geneticist Richard Lewontin.
That is the one point which I think all evolutionists are agreed upon, that it is virtually impossible to do a better job than an organism is doing in its own environment.
If anting wasn't positively useful for survival and reproduction, natural selection would long ago have favoured individuals who refrained from it. A Darwinian might be tempted to say the same of religion, hence the need for this discussion. To an evolutionist, religious rituals stand out like peacocks in a sunlit glade, Dan Dennett's phrase. Religious behaviour is a writ large human equivalent of anting or bower building. It is time-consuming, energy-consuming, often as extravagantly ornate as the plumage of a bird of paradise. Religion can endanger the life of the pious individual, as well as the lives of others. Thousands of people have been tortured for their loyalty to a religion, persecuted by zealots for what is, in many cases, a scarcely distinguishable alternative faith. Religion devours resources, sometimes on a massive scale. A medieval cathedral could consume 100 man sanctuaries in its construction, yet was never used as a dwelling or for any recognisably useful purpose. Was it some kind of architectural peacock's tail? If so, at whom was the advertisement aimed? Sacred music and devotional paintings largely monopolized medieval and Renaissance talent. Devout people have died for their gods and killed for them, whipped blood from their backs, sworn themselves to a lifetime of celibacy or to lonely silence, all in the service of religion. What is it all for? What is the benefit of religion?
By benefit, the Darwinian normally means some enhancement to the survival of the individual's genes. What is missing from this is the important point that Darwinian benefit is not restricted to the genes of the individual organism. There are three possible alternative targets of benefit. One arises from the theory of group selection, and I'll come to that. The second follows from the theory that I advocated in The Extended Phenotype. The individual you are watching may be working under the manipulative influence of genes in another individual, perhaps a parasite. Dan Dennett reminds us that the common cold is universal to all human peoples in much the same way as religion is, yet we would not want to suggest that colds benefit us. Plenty of examples are known of animals manipulated into behaving in such a way as to benefit the transmission of a parasite to its next host. I encapsulated the point in my central theorem of the extended phenotype. An animal's behavior tends to maximize the survival of the genes for that behavior, whether or not those genes happen to be in the body of the particular animal performing it. Third, the central theorem may substitute for genes the more general term replicators. The fact that religion is ubiquitous probably means that it has worked to the benefit of something, but it may not be us or our genes. It may be to the benefit of only the religious ideas themselves, to the extent that they behave in a somewhat gene-like way as replicators. I shall deal with this below under the heading Tread Softly, Because You Tread on My Memes. Meanwhile, I press on with more traditional interpretations of Darwinism, in which benefit is assumed to mean benefit to individual survival and reproduction.
Hunter-gatherer peoples, such as Australian Aboriginal tribes, presumably live in something like the way our distant ancestors did. The New Zealand-Australian philosopher of science Kim Sterelny points up a dramatic contrast in their lives. On the one hand, Aboriginals are superb survivors under conditions that test their practical skills to the uttermost. But Sterelny goes on, intelligent as our species might be, we are perversely intelligent. The very same peoples who are so savvy about the natural world and how to survive in it simultaneously clutter their minds with beliefs that are palpably false, and for which the word useless is a generous understatement. Sterelny himself is familiar with Aboriginal peoples of Papua New Guinea. They survive under arduous conditions where food is hard to come by dint of
a legendarily accurate understanding of their biological environment. But they combine this understanding with deep and destructive obsessions about female menstrual pollution and about witchcraft. Many of the local cultures are tormented by fears of witchcraft and magic, and by the violence that accompanies those fears.
Sterelny challenges us to explain
how we can be simultaneously so smart and so dumb.
Though the details differ across the world, no known culture lacks some version of the time-consuming, wealth-consuming, hostility-provoking rituals, the anti-factual, counterproductive fantasies of religion. Some educated individuals may have abandoned religion, but all were brought up in a religious culture from which they usually had to make a conscious decision to depart. The old Northern Ireland joke, "Yes, but are you a Protestant atheist or a Catholic atheist?" is spiked with bitter truth. Religious behavior can be called a human universal in the same way as heterosexual behavior can. Both generalizations allow individual exceptions, but all those exceptions understand only too well the rule from which they have departed. Universal features of a species demand a Darwinian explanation. Obviously, there is no difficulty in explaining the Darwinian advantage of sexual behavior. It is about making babies, even on those occasions where contraception or homosexuality seems to belie it. But what about religious behavior? Why do humans fast, kneel, genuflect, self-flagellate, nod maniacally towards a wall, crusade, or otherwise indulge in costly practices that can consume life and, in extreme cases, terminate it.
Direct advantages of religion. There is a little evidence that religious belief protects people from stress-related diseases. The evidence is not strong, but it would not be surprising if it were true, for the same kind of reason as